is now recording, for better or worse.
Okay.
When I was at the Women's Club last night with Bishop Bolton and the Filibusters Club, he remarked on the beauty of that house and how well it's been preserved. And I, of course, immediately remembered the many gorgeous houses that used to be here in Alliance that we haven't been able to preserve. Some of those grand houses up along Union Avenue in the vicinity of the college that are just gone now. And then I had to tell him the story of the Morgan Castle and how we very nearly lost that to a commercial shopping center, but because the Board of Education and public-spirited citizens got together, we were able to save that Glamorgan Castle and have it used for a good public purpose and preserve so that people might come across that wonder of seeing this huge castle in the middle of a small town like Alliance.
So, had you been in the home as you were growing up? Was this
no, although I was in Parkway Grade School with the granddaughter of Colonel Morgan, who built Glamorgan Castle, and she used to talk about the castle, but I was never in there when it was a private home, and I was never in the now Woman's Club when it was a private home. That was mostly a generation before mine, my mother
yes,
and father
yes.
and so forth. But I'm glad to see that we have been able to keep some of the good things from the past. You were looking at the picture on the wall there of the old Alliance Public Library, which stood about a block from where we are now today in Rodman Public Library. And I can remember trudging up the steps of that building to take out books. Of course, it's gone, and the old Alliance High School, which stood behind it, is gone. But at least that land has been saved for a good public purpose because the high-rise senior citizens housing now sits there. And I can remember that this area at that time was called Hazel Park, named for Hazel Rodman. And the physical education classes from the old high school used to come over here when the weather was as good as it is today and have our workouts out of doors. So things have changed.
Well, when did your family come here originally to Alliance, your ancestors?
My father moved here with his father, who was Dean John Brady Bowman of Mount Union College, when Dean Bowman first came to Mount Union to begin his teaching career.
Was that your grandfather?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was about, well, I would think 1905, 1906. Okay. They moved here from a farm, which was down in the Paris, East Canton area.
Mm-hmm.
At about the same time, my grandfather, Allett, my mother's father, was coming to Alliance from Summerdale, down near New Philadelphia, to open a hardware store with a man named Kreider. And the Allett Kreider Hardware was established
on... How is that spelled?
A-L-L-O-T-T. Two T's, yes. Kreider was K-R-I-D-E-R.
Hardware, okay.
And that was down on what is, what used to be called the Square, public square in downtown Alliance, the corner of Main and Freedom, the southeast corner, sort of catty-cornered from where City Hall still stands. So both the Allett family and the Bowman family came to town about the same time. My mother lived with her family out on South Union Avenue at the corner of what is now Milton Street, and that house still stands. My father lived with his family on West State Street on a house which is no longer there but was moved around on Rock Hill Avenue. So the house still exists, at least where he grew up. And from all I remember them telling me, they were sweethearts from early high school days on. And they both went to Mount Union College, continued their courtship there, and were married just prior to graduation because World War I had broken out. My father had volunteered for the Army and was allowed to graduate early that year, 1917, and so he and my mother were married at that time. And and the family, some of us, have been rattling around the place ever since.
How many brothers and sisters?
I have one brother, an older brother, John, whom most of the people in the Alliance area knew as Jack. He was born in 1922, graduated from Alliance High School in 1940, won a national scholarship to Harvard, graduated from there, came back after World War II, and for a time was sales manager for then the Alliance Manufacturing Company. Left town about 1949, and other than visiting, then he never came back. He's been gone several years now. But,
now, about your hardware business, did your family, the Bowmans, are they involved in the business as well as your...
Well, there was an interesting story there, and I didn't learn many of the finer details until later years, some from my brother. But after my father came back from World War I, he went to work for Alliance Manufacturing Company as sales manager, and was there until 1929. And then, of course, the Depression brought many things to a fall. And at that time, he left Alliance Manufacturing Company and went downtown to manage the, what was by then just the Allied Hardware Company, to manage the company for his brother-in-law, Guy Allott, who was one of my mother's brothers, who was blind. But by that time, he owned the store, and so my father went down and managed the Allott Hardware store for 10 years in downtown Alliance. I knew very little of that because this was just about the time I was arriving in the world, but I gather that often occurs between brother-in-law and so forth, why it was not the happiest of relationships. What I do remember is that in 1939, when I was 9 years old, my father moved to Mount Union, the Mount Union area, and opened his own hardware store.
What happened to it?
Well, that ran for 25 years until we closed it in 1964. We were located on South Union Avenue, as Dad's advertising said, just 51 steps north of Mount Union Square, and the store operated for 25 years there, and was just a modest-sized hardware business, and that's where I first began to work in the hardware business. And after my father's death, I continued as manager until my mother and I decided that it was better to close it.
Did the chains affect
your
business?
Sure.
And you've seen this type of thing happen, as well as the loss of lots of the big homes in your lifetime.
Yes, exactly. It was a mom-and-pop store, like a lot of the mom-and-pop groceries, and there was an era there, half a century, when that was the kind of store that best served the needs of the people. But times do change, and we recognize that. And, of course, those big homes served the well-to-do people of their time, and those times have changed, too. So it's, although the streets are all in the same place as they used to be when I was a kid, and I would certainly recognize the community. There is much within the community that is significantly different from what it was when I can remember. I don't remember much when I was a kid. I guess maybe I blocked that out, but I remember being down at the grand opening of the Bowman Hardware Company in 1939 and standing there until very late in the evening and being very tired, but also being very excited because people were coming in and they were handing out things.
Harriet said you'd be a great interview. For sure. That's great.
That was a wonderful time, and and I think it was the hardware business turned out later, although I didn't realize it at the time, the hardware business, I think, was a good training ground for my later public career, because my father always insisted, and then we did after him, that customers' needs were what was important. If the customer needed something and we couldn't provide it, then it was our job to say, I'm sorry, we don't have that. If he thought he wanted something and we knew that he could really do it with a lot less, it was our job to tell him that. And so this idea of serving the customer truthfully and faithfully, I think, is an idea that I took over into public life. And I always regarded the constituency, that is the taxpayers or whatever, as customers.
This gives you peace of mind, doesn't it?
It really does. And when they were in to see me or to see our office, our job was to find out what their needs were and attempt to serve them. I've been in government offices, and so have you, that don't operate that way. They regard the citizen as sort of an imposter or someone who's interrupting their business. And as I say, I didn't invent that. I learned that at my family's hardware store.
Now, did you always live here and commute back to Canton?
Oh, yes. We've until very recent years, I lived in Alliance all my life. When I took the work in Canton, which was not until after the hardware store closed and after my brief career in radio broadcasting ended. There's an interlude in there.
I bet you were good at that, too.
Oh, I don't know. I had a lot of fun with that. When we closed the hardware store, Tony Gates, who was then manager of WFAH, came to me and said, how would you like to be director of public affairs? We're trying to expand our service to the community. We're trying to develop a lot more interviews with local people so that the community will know we're here. We think that's something you can do. And I had been on a volunteer basis announcing a little classical music program, which I called Sunday Symphony, 2 hours of classical music on Sunday afternoon that I would put together from the WFAH record library and write my own program notes. And so Tony, who was also a classical musician, felt I could carry out the duties of this new post that he had in mind. And Don Peterson was at that time owner of the radio station, and I guess perhaps still is as we talk today. But so I went with them as director of public affairs and was there until about 3 years later, when the man who was then the auditor of Stark County, Joe Yoder, came to me and asked if I would be interested in getting into government on a full-time basis. I'd had a brief political career, and I don't know whether this is the time to talk about that or not. I remember when I was teenager that some people in the community came to my father and asked him to run for mayor of Alliance. This was in the early 40s, I would guess. And I remember how vehement he was about saying no. Didn't want anything to do with politics. He wasn't going to entertain that notion for the slightest length of time, and he didn't. And so I respected my father, and I kind of got that same feeling about politics. But at any rate, he did agree along the line to take a couple of jobs. He was on the Board of Health for many years, and he served as Civil Defense Director, which was the forerunner of the Disaster Services Director that now exists in the community. And after his death, that post was taken by L.J. Horton. And L.J. Horton then in the late 1950s became city auditor for a time. And the man who was then mayor of Alliance, Dave Mainwaring, asked me to become the Civil Defense Disaster Director. So that was my first entry into the area of government, although I had been a political science major at Mount Union and just graduated there a couple years before. But it was about that time that some people who were basically of my age were beginning to run for things like city council and state legislature and so on. And so I kind of drifted into the political arena, so to speak, although was not intensely active in it. In 1963, Jim Rhodes became governor of Ohio and asked Dave Mainwaring to leave the post of mayor in Alliance and go down to be his registrar of motor vehicles. Dave left, and that meant that in the election of 1963, someone else would be running for mayor. And at that time, some people in the community who should have had better sense came to me and asked me if I would be interested in running. And so I did, and I won the Republican primary and then finished second to Dale Walborn in the mayor's race. So my political career started out with a crashing loss because the Republicans had occupied the mayor's office for almost 20 years, an unbroken string, and I brought that to a rousing halt.
Now, what year would that have?
That was 1963.
Okay, was there kind of a period there where the Democrats won overall?
Yes, the Democrats enjoyed success that year and for several years yet to follow, and there were a lot of things involved, but I enjoy reminding people who have looked at my political career that I began with a crashing loss, and as it turned out, it was a very good thing, and not only that it made the other political career possible, but also you need to remember that when someone wins an election, somebody else is losing it. It does keep you humble in a way.
I don't think I'm supposed to say this. You know, this is your story, but I have never heard anything derogatory about you.
Whoa, well, you must not have been paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, okay. You do such hear such kind of evil things about some people, but I'm sure you handled yourself. So.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I've always tried to carry out my political career or any career in a forthright and clean manner.
Did this come from your family's training? Is this sort of?
I guess it's the only way, really, that I ever learned how to do anything was try to do it honestly. And I can remember early on. My dad telling me, if somebody comes in and asks something, don't make it up. Tell them you don't know. Well, I found when I entered political life that there are many people in political life who have a horror of saying, I don't know. And it was always easy for me, if I didn't know, to say, I don't know, but I'll try to find out, or I'll put you in touch with the person who does know. And I found that was a lot easier to do than to try to fudge around in an area without adequate information and so on. So I very much appreciate the fact that you haven't heard anything derogatory about me. I've tried to do things as honestly and straightforwardly as I can. I don't think any of us ever succeed, you know, totally,
yeah.
But
can't please everybody,
no,
as they say.
No, we certainly can't please everybody, but going back to that 1963 election, then I decided that would be it for politics. I had no more interest in that. And then in 1965, the Republican leaders came back to me and said, we'd like you to run for council at large. And I said, well, that's, I have no particular interest in that, but if you think it would be a good thing to do, I will do that. And this is another story I like to tell. In 1963 campaign for mayor, I worked as hard as I knew how to get elected. I went door to door, I went to every meeting, I shook hands, I made speeches, I ran ads, I put out bumper stickers, I mailed cards, I did everything in the world I knew to get elected. And I lost. In 1965, when I was still somewhat flattened by my loss 2 years previously, I spent not a dime on the campaign, did not make a public appearance, did not run an ad, and I led the ticket. So when people tell you that the secret to political success is to work hard and do this and that and the other thing, I say, but I know better, because I haven't any idea. You could speculate that it was the holdover. I lost to a very fine man in 1963, whose name was Dale Walborn, who served as mayor of Alliance very honorably for 8 years, and the reservoir, the water reservoir, is named after him. It was a very clean campaign. He was a good mayor, and it may have been that people were not voting so much against me as they were for him, and then 2 years later, with a chance to vote for me, decided that that they would do that. Who knows? But anyway,
you were well known in the community. Yeah,
without lifting a finger, I led the ticket, and was serving on council in my first term, and had already filed a petition to run for re-election when Joe Yoder, who had been auditor of Stark County for 24 of his 32 years there, came to me and said, I need an administrative assistant. I have hired John Thorpe of Alliance to be my accountant, and now I need someone to run the office and administer these things. And at that point, it seemed like a good thing to do. I was still interested in government, and I'd had this experience in politics, and I was active in municipal government, and here was a chance to move to county government and get involved in the administration of that. So, as it turned out, Ohio law demanded that I leave city council. Could not hold the two jobs simultaneously. This is my last, perhaps, political story. I don't know. But so I left city council. Too late to get my name off the ballot for re-election. But I took out an ad in the paper and I said, I have left city council. I cannot be a candidate for re-election. My name is on the ballot. Please do not vote for me because I am not a candidate. I have taken this other job. Well, you know what happened. The election came and I led the ticket again. So I've never known whether that election in particular was a tribute to my popularity or just an indication that people don't pay any attention to politics and they vote for a name, you know, that they recognize and trust. But at any rate, obviously I couldn't be, and by the time fall came, it was a moot question because I was very much involved as deputy auditor for Mr. Yoder. And after 7 years in that position, he came to me in 1973 and said, I've been here 32 years and I'm not going to run for re-election. I would like you to run for re-election, for election to this post, which I have occupied for all these years. So I agreed to do that. And in 1974, I knew I had to get around the county and make myself known. And so I began a drill of appearances and press releases and musical programs and whatever that reminded me, when I stopped to think about it, of how hard I had worked to become mayor of Alliance in 1963. And occasionally, I would wake up about 2 a.m. and think, are you going down this same trap again? But as it turned out, that effort paid off, and I was elected auditor of the county in 1974 and re-elected in 1978 and in 1982 and in 1986. And in the 1990 election, I decided to retire from public office. My wife was being transferred to the Cambridge area, and it seemed a good time to leave. So that very succinctly is the story of my political career with the some pluses and some minuses.
Do you miss it now?
No. I miss government. I think government is important. And I think government is too important to be left by default to those who would use it for their own purposes or the totally incompetent. And we have plenty of both in government, unfortunately. We have crooks and we have numbskulls. I'm not going to name any names, obviously, but
can I turn that off?
We have crooks and we have numbskulls in government. But I think government is too important to simply let the crooks and the numbskulls have it all, because none of the rest of us want to mess with it. So I miss government. Government was good to me. It gave me the opportunity to meet thousands and thousands of people and to be of service to them. Politics, I don't miss at all. I never really liked the political process, the hurly-burly, and I would never engage in what passes today for, say, presidential politics, where the candidates spend most of their time trying to make you believe that the other candidate is a direct descendant of Attila the Hun. I would never allow any campaign in which I was involved to say anything about the opposing candidate. As far as I was concerned, the purpose of a campaign for me was to make people acquainted with me, my education, my training, my background, and if I had any, my accomplishments, and to decide whether they wanted me in a particular political office. Who the other opponent was or what the other opponent stood for was somebody else's business, not mine.
From your background at Mount Union, which is a Methodist school, has a lot of religion about you. You'd make a great minister. Did you ever think of going into that?
People have asked me that since my marriage to Susan, who of course is a United Methodist minister and is now a United Methodist district superintendent. And I've told her, told them and told her the same thing. I could never, I don't think I could be a minister. That requires a very special kind of person, I think, a person who is very much open to the sensitive nuances of other people and has a vision of the Bible and the gospel, and Susan has that in abundance. She's a splendid minister. Bishop Bolton, with whom I opened this interview talking last night at the Woman's Club, has that measuring myself and my own resources against those people. No, I don't think I could be a minister. But it is, again, I regard that as a compliment that someone might think so. And of course, my grandfather, Dean Bowman, was a minister, although his career was in college education, but he preached quite a bit, and there have been no ministers in the family since his time. I would not have any objections if some of my grandchildren were to become ministers. I think it's an important, a vital calling that can render immense service to human beings in some of their most personal areas, but I really think it takes a special combination of gifts and interests that I don't think I have. But thank you anyway.
Did the college bring your family here, your ancestors, your grandfathers?
Yes. And really, so much of what I've been in Alliance and seen in Alliance has centered around Mount Union College. I can remember going to the football games with my father when I was a small kid, and going myself then to football games after that, and basketball games and watching Jack Rehfeld's baseball teams and going over to musical events. I can remember Cecil Stewart, who was a marvelous choral director back in the time before I ever thought I'd be a choral director, directing annually Messiah over in Memorial Hall. And that was such a thrilling thing for me to go over there and sit and hear this huge chorus and these wonderful soloists perform this magnificent work. So, and plays at the college, and later I was to become active at Rodman Playhouse in the technical area. So much of what Alliance meant to me as a child and as an adult was part of the college being part of Alliance, and always seemed to live just on the edge of the campus. I grew up on State Street, and then we...
Do you know the number of the house?
602. 602 was where we grew up, and Dean Bowman's widow lived in the back part of the house, and the rest of us lived in the front part of the house, and then we moved to 38 East College, which was just across Union Avenue from the entrance to the college along there. And when I built a home in Alliance finally, that was on Parkside Drive, which was just a couple blocks west of the west edge of the campus. So my life in Alliance was always on the edge of the campus. I can when we were kids, and I lived on State Street, which was between Shunk and Ridgewood. And there was one gang of kids which we called the Shunk Street Skunks, and the other gang was called the Ridgewood Ramblers, and I belonged to the Shunk Street Skunks. But anyway, we went straight across State Street and played football and softball and baseball on the college campus. Now, we couldn't do that now because the large Timken Gym and Peterson Fieldhouse now occupies that which at that time was a grassy area with the old Clark Observatory in the middle of it. But the college never seemed to mind. We didn't destroy anything. We just used the grassy area to play. And I think we didn't realize at the time maybe how lucky we were to be able to just run across the street and have this huge grassy area play sports park. On. It was our own park, and now so often kids have to travel considerable distances to get to a place. And of course, when I was growing up, the sports and games were for kids. That is, we played during the day, and there was little organized. We organized ourselves and played and chose up teams and everything. And I've seen that change over the years, and I'm not all sure that it's a change for the better. Although I was involved in Hot Stove League Baseball for years as a player and then a manager and a team sponsor and so forth, it strikes me that a lot of what we do these days in games for children is really for the adults. We've taken the games away from the kids too much. I don't think the kids are 8 or 9 years now that get all dressed up in fancy uniforms a couple hours, a couple evenings a week, have as much fun as we used to have organizing ourselves and playing all day long, because everything they do in the present day situation is set by an adult. The adult says, well, you play there, and the adult says, well, you don't play this game because Johnny is going to play, and the adult says, that's over. And in our day, we umpired our own games, we played our own rules, and I think we had more fun.
It was a game.
It was a game.
That's and, interesting.
As I say, I'm as guilty as anyone because, and even in Hot Stove League Baseball, I can recall when I was a teenager playing Hot Stove League Baseball, and we didn't have any adults around. We played games in the morning in the summer. We rode our bikes to the game fields. There were older boys who were umpires. We had patchy uniforms at best, but we had a wonderful time, and it was for us. Now, when my kids were growing up, things had changed, so I got into the hot stove league process as a manager and managed the teams that my kids were on. But I thought as I was watching them, it's a little bit too organized, it's a little bit too much of us adults in it. They would have a lot more fun if they could do it as we used to do it.
I think it puts a lot of pressure on
sure
the
does sure does need. Yeah. Games, there ought to be time for games that are games that are fun. And I've seen, and fortunately it's not a commonplace thing, but I have seen hot stove league adults berate players, sometimes not their own children, sometimes their own children, carry on as spectators or as managers in a way that I thought was just absolutely awful. And so I guess it's kind of nostalgic looking back at old houses and old games and everything, but sometimes I think that not everything that changes changes for the better. Change is not always progress, has been my feeling. And it isn't that I think that everything that's old is good and everything that's new or young is bad. A lot of things we do a lot better than we used to, but some things we've lost a little bit along the way.
You didn't need $100 shoes,
did you? My goodness, I'm glad my kids grew up before the shoes got so expensive.
What about your children? How many do you have and where are they now?
Well, I have four children from my first marriage. Paul lives here in Alliance and works for the Stark County Engineer. He operates heavy equipment. Bruce is married, lives here in Alliance, has a daughter and a son, first grandson, just born as we speak 2 weeks ago before this interview. Bonnie is married, lives in Tucson, Arizona, and has two daughters. And Julie is a first-year law student at the University of Arizona. My wife Susan has two children, John, who is a professional real estate appraiser who lives north of Alliance in Lexington Township, and Lisa, who is a United Methodist minister. Now, there's a minister in the family, you see, who has been in Glasgow, Scotland, serving as an associate pastor and working on her PhD at the University of Glasgow. She is returning to this country in May of this year, and beginning in July, she will have her own church in the Youngstown area, United Methodist Church. So those are the six children and the four grandchildren that I'm currently aware of.
Well, did you meet Susan at your wife's name?
Yes.
At college? Or
no, I met Susan when I, and that spins off another story about my musical career, which has been, well, it has been very important to me, and if it is all right, I'll tramp back a little
sure,
in time.
Sure.
I told you I used to go over and hear Cecil Stewart to direct his choirs. He was good. I enjoyed them. And I can remember enjoying Fern Miller, who was the organist at Union Avenue Methodist Church, where I grew up, and how impressed I was with her organ playing and the church service with the choir singing. My mother sang in that choir up there until she was about 80 years old. So anyway, this was my exposure to music, and occasionally a concert by the Marine Band that would come on tour or something like that. And every time I got to hear music like that, I just loved it. So I knew I really liked music. I liked it so much, in fact, that my mother decided I should take piano lessons. So I studied piano with Fern Miller for a year and a half. And it was a study career that I cut kind of short, because I used to play ball in the summer, and as ball players do, especially not real good ones, I It's always damaging my fingers. And so I'd arrive for my piano lesson, which was 50 cents back in those days, with my fingers all bandaged up. And one day, Fern Miller said to me, Billy, you're going to have to decide between the piano and baseball. Well, that was real easy. So I went home and told my mother that as long as I was playing baseball, I couldn't take piano lessons anymore. And that ended too soon, that my professional career of study in music. But never lost my interest in it. And when I was a teenager, I was hospitalized for a long period of time with ulcerative colitis. And that caused me to be almost totally bedfast for almost a year. And during that time, I'd always been an avid reader, but during that time I became an avid listener to classical music. And that is an interest that has stayed with me through the years. When I was drafted, I had not done much with the piano. I thought that
was... Excuse me just a second. Yes. I don't want to lose a word of this.
Okay. Are we running out of tape?
I don't know, but I don't know beans.
It will stop.
It will stop. All right. Okay.
It'll just go clunk,
okay.
So we'll be all right.
Okay.
I was drafted in the Korean War. And Army Signal Corps. I was a cryptographer. And I was stationed on a little island called Okinawa, where the cryptographic headquarters for the entire Far East Command was headquartered during the Korean conflict. And there I worked on cryptographic shift 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, which left little time for recreation. Not that there was much on Okinawa, but there was a day room with a bar and so forth, and a piano. And one day somebody was whistling a tune, and they said, "Oh, that and the way that tune goes." And so I sat down and played it for them. I always was able to play by ear. Well, that sealed my fate, I guess, because from that time on, any time I was in the day room, which was maybe an hour or two a day, why people wanted to hear their songs, and I played them. And that is something that I've kept with ever since. And I've got two separate tracks here, and I don't know which one to tell you about. I'll tell you about that first, because anyway, when I came out of the Army, I was still interested in playing what I would call popular piano, and continued with that. It was about 1963, the same year that everything else happened, when I was at a Christmas party at the house of Jim Rodman, whose parents made this library possible. And Maggie Rodman, who's on the library board, had given Jim a set of drums, a trap drum set for Christmas. And he had it set up down in the family room of their house, and there was a piano by, and he was banging away on these drums, and I sat down at the piano and started to play a few tunes with him. And therein was born a musical organization that's been known over the years as the JR4. That's Jim Rodman, and most of the time there have been four of us. And we have existed as a non-professional little jazz combo now for almost 30 years. And we meet at Jim's house maybe once or twice a month and play for an hour and a half or so, and it's relaxation. Well, along the way somebody knew that we existed, and so we've played over the years for numerous functions, most of them at the college, because Hugh Jay, who's a professor at the college, has been our bass player for most of this time, and Dean Conrad Stanitsky currently is our saxophone and clarinet player. Of course, I'm